Money begins right now. Live from the NASDAQ market site overlooking New York City's Times Square, I'm Melissa Lear. Traders on the desk are Tim Seymour, Karen Feinerman, Brian Kelly, and Guy Adami. Tech front and center for your money as we gear up for a huge week of earnings. We'll break down the key names that need to be on your radar. Big tech executives wrapping up a big meeting at the White House right now, and Huawei will take you live to Washington with the very latest. And Whirlpool whiplash, the stock seeing a big reversal after hours despite an earnings beat. We'll tell you what analysts are saying about this move. But we begin with the most important week of earnings season. More than 130 S&P 500 companies reporting results, including three big FANG names, Facebook, Amazon, and Google. So we thought we'd play a game.
A new game.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. In this week's tech reports, wow, of those names, Facebook, Amazon, and Alphabet, which is the good, the bad, and the ugly? It's a new game, Guy. We're depending on you.
It's just a new game.
Yeah. And yet an old song.
Yeah. I mean, yes, a classic
song. Can you name any of the actors in Good, Bad, the Ugly?
Why do you ask me questions you know I don't know any of them for? Okay,
so. Oddly enough, and I'm glad to be here on a Monday, I'm very excited to play this new game. The way you line them up on the screen is the way I would line them up in my head. The good will be Facebook. Why is that? Well, you know what? All the, I like that when they do that.
They have to whistle, too.
All the good, you know, every the bad news they've thrown at it doesn't matter. The stock made a 50% correction of a recent move when it traded down 164 on huge volume. I've said for a while I don't want to like it, but I think it's going to retest the old highs. That's the good. The bad, Amazon. Not because necessarily the quarter's going to be bad, but I think the price action might be. You know, we push up against those levels we saw in September, I believe, of last year, 2025. I think there's potential for a double top. That's why that's the bad. And the ugly, as much as I hate to say it, and Karen's not going to like me for this, I think Alphabet might be the ugly. And it's going to be the ugly because, quite frankly, over the last three or four quarters, it's been exactly that. I don't see any reason why it's going to change now.
Do you think Facebook could be the ugly?
I think it could be the meh, right. I could. It could because
that's not really
it's
an option
not quite
in this
the game,
Karen,
but all right. I'm going to take a little liberty. And I am long, and so sort of begs the question, aren't it? If you're long and you're not that excited about earnings, why are you still long? To me, it's a much bigger story than one or two quarters. I don't like that last quarter at all. There was a lot to not like about it. And I don't know that it'll turn around right away. I'm not wildly optimistic about it. However, the valuation at this level is so compelling to me that I feel like I can wait a while and just see how. I mean, this is an extraordinary business. Trading, if you back out the cash at 16 times earnings, 16 times for this kind of business, that's extraordinary. So I'm going to hang on to that. I'm nervous about it for sure. Facebook, I'm in Guy's camp. I'm more optimistic about that. And Google, you gotta do a better job explaining yourself if you have another weak quarter, which you might, which is okay. That happens. But we need more explanation if it does.
Well, I guess, you know, I fit somewhere in the middle. I tend to agree on Google with Karen. But, you know, Guy had Amazon, I believe, as his
bad.
Yeah. He had Facebook as his good and his Google was his ugly. So my good would actually be Amazon. My bad would actually be Facebook.
Yeah, that's what makes markets.
Right. Which makes a good fast money show. Here's why Amazon, I think, is good. They focused on profitability over the last, you know, four or five quarters, much to, I think, you know, at times disappointment because people finally were looking at this company is a growth company that stopped growing. And how do you have this multiple? But ultimately, I do think that they're going to start to give you kind of north of 20% FX neutral growth again. And I think that's really the issue. I think when I look at Facebook, despite the fact that it's been, and maybe because of it's been such a great run for the stock, the realities around the regulatory environment that the Libra coin is not a game changer for them revenue wise anytime soon. And that you have a case where I actually think that their guidance on the expense and the expense margins continues to go through the roof. I mean, that would probably be my ugly if it wasn't for Google, which I do think is a great company and agree with Karen. The problem with Google right now and what makes this quarter ugly, not the company and not the valuation and not a long position I have, is that I do think that there continues to be margin compression. And then Google Properties, which is supposed to be this exciting growth engine of all these great little things they own, frankly, last quarter was showed deceleration, and I think it's going to be below 20% again. So until they give me something out of YouTube and until the regulatory environment changes, I think it's tough sledding.
I mean, does the setup going in terms of the price action of the stock into earnings play a role into what you decide to be good, bad, and ugly?
It does for me, absolutely. So you've taken something like Google, which is my ugly. That has lagged behind all these others. We're talking about other stocks that are near their highs. Maybe they're going to do double tops. Maybe they're going to break out. Google has lagged behind. So put that one in the ugly category until it proves itself. The other two, I think, are a little trickier. Facebook has had some decent action, price action recently. But also the news has been terrible on it, really, right? I mean, they have been completely under attack. Libra and the Libra coin and Calibra is probably several years away. They're trying to combine it to make it this, with trying to compete with WeChat, this kind of super app internationally. So until that's resolved, I think there's going to be a cloud over it. But the price action's pretty decent. So put that in the middle. What is the middle?
No, there is no middle.
Well, yeah, there is. There's three.
Good.
There's,
so there's and a little bad.
Good
and right.
Ugly. Pretty a bad and a
good,
very
bad
ugly.
And ugly.
Right. Right.
So you think so Facebook
I'm going to go,
bad.
But and then so Facebook's the bad, and then the good. If I had a fistful of dollars, I would buy Amazon.
Oh, you see what he did there?
Yeah, you see what I did? That's a thinker.
I got that. I think.
Yeah.
That's a movie, right?
One of the movies. Yeah.
Clint Eastwood. Very good. Yeah.
One of the actors, by the way.
Would you rate them the same way?
If
the price action going into the earnings report weren't different.
So you're changing the game.
I'm just wondering because when I asked
wasn't that
DK
part of the question?
About, yeah, I mean that is that
you, is it about the earnings themselves?
Going into
or the
earnings,
stock
right.
Response?
So I guess the question is
how I answer.
Was your ranking?
That's a great question.
Guess
so
on Amazon, what the
okay, so no,
will
I'll
be,
play along or, with your reindeer games there, young lady. If Amazon was still floundering at that $1,800 level, where it traded down to, by the way, last quarter, I might give it a little bit of a different rating.
Because you think the earnings report ultimately is going to be decent, but it's the setup going in, the
that
run
was,
in the stock.
That's
how about the
what
run
was,
in the stock and Facebook going into
but
earnings?
And that's a little different because of all the bad news. You had that flush to the downside, retest the highs, traded down to 164, 50% retracement on monster volume. Now the stock, with a myriad of bad news, has only gone higher, which in my book makes that the good.
I don't understand how the price action for any company, if we're talking about price action, and we have a great chartist who I know is going to come here and put it really in his own words. But ultimately, if you've got a company like Amazon, which is near all-time highs again, has traded, you know, if you look at that chart, it's almost been essentially a move to the next level higher. And if you think about what Facebook did, these are both reasons why people, I think, should be cautious. Now, of course, I was positive. I was good on Amazon and I was bad on Facebook. But Facebook's move, Brian, I think you pointed it out. I mean, if LibraCoin is something that if only invites more regulatory hassle for the company, gave it I don't know, is it $30 billion in market cap based upon that move? For what? For something that's not going to move the needle?
Yeah, for me, it goes to sentiment. And I think that's what you're talking about, right? What is the sentiment going into the print? When I look at Amazon and I look at what the earnings estimates are compared to where we were the last time we were up at these prices, earnings estimates are lower. So therefore, people aren't expecting as much out of Amazon. So there's more of a potential for an upside surprise in my view. So that's how I view them.
All right, let's settle this score.
Do it.
A lot of disagreement as to what the good and the bad and the ugly is going to be. What are the charts saying will be the good, the bad, and the ugly in this week's FANG reports? The chart master, Carter Worth, is here to break it down. Hey, Carter.
Well, I'm not sure I can break any ties or settle it because, as we know, everything you said was very subjective. It's a lot of opinion. And so, too, it is with charts, meaning you can draw the lines different ways. Different charters come up with different conclusions. But since I'm the chartist standing here, let's draw them the way I'm going to draw them. And I would start with the following. Always no drawings, no charts. And now something to bring it to life. What we know, and there's no way around this, right, is that Amazon, and you discussed this, has returned to its former high. And this setup typically, you call it an ascending wedge or whatever, represents a lot of tension. And my thinking here is that this is the good, and that Amazon is going to break out, it's going to exceed this high. Backing and filling is normal. When you first approach a high, you contend with it, then you exceed it. So Amazon's the one that I think is the best of the three. Moving on, let's go another way to look at the charts. Some people like to call them cups and handles, but either way, it's the same premise that this setup, you get to the high, you back away, you reapproach the high, that it gets resolved higher. Second is Google. Now, this is just a big old mess. We know, and you spoke of this, the double top, put in some lines. It's not only a double top, It's a double bottom. And basically, the thing is all over the place. It's not rewarding winners. It's not rewarding losers. It's not a buyable. It's not sell. And notice the gapping and dropping. This is the problem. But most problematic, next chart for Google, it's all about alpha. This stock made new two-year relative lows as recently as 4 or 5 weeks ago, meaning it's not performing. And that is a factor that comes back as very robust in almost all back tests. And then the one that's sort of in the middle, my bias again is the downside, is Facebook. And the issue with Facebook is this. I'm going to try to zoom in here. It's all of these gaps. So that's a gap, yes? Well, there's another gap. Here's a huge gap. The problem with this action is that this is almost schizophrenic. Basically, you have the following: a gap down, and then we have, of course, a gap up, a gap up, a gap up, a gap up. Is the next one down? This is almost untradeable. My bias here, although this is the one that's the middle of the road, is down. So it's Amazon, from my point of view, is best in class.
So Amazon, then Facebook, then Alphabet.
Then Google.
Carter, why don't you come on over to the desk?
You bet.
Yeah. We'll bring the chair over.
Did any of us match up?
Love the gap.
You and I matched up. There we go. I like that.
Nice.
Google's the ugly. Yeah.
I think that was exactly what it was.
So, Carter, explain to us the gaps.
Right.
How
do
you think about the gaps?
Well, think about what a security, when a market opens, right, your markets used to open late. They'd have halted specialists trying to match up if you had an overwhelming number of buyers or sellers. Now most stocks open quite quickly, right? Almost on the open. To have so much selling pressure, the biotech FDA phase 3 did not come through, and the stock's indicated down 20%. That's what a gap is, down or a gap up. You get FDA approval, meaning you need shocking news. That would be the most shocking FDA approval, right, of anything, to have a security gap up or gap down. What's happened in Facebook is there's so many gaps. It turns out that the quarterly reporting is almost unanalyzable. It turns out that for every time someone's got it right, there's another person's got it wrong, and it's a highly volatile, highly schizophrenic situation.
Haven't a couple of those gaps to the downside been all about an earnings announcement?
Well, that's
where,
right.
In fact, they gave you, some
and,
reason.
And it could happen
to the
again.
Upside, though.
And to the upside.
Their last
that's
earnings.
Right. Which makes it was such a fascinating thing because this is one of the most well-observed companies in the world, and yet somehow all the Qs and Ks, all the DCF, all the dividend discount models can't predict the results. And that's the whole hope, is that somehow you can analyze it and predict what's happening. It turns out nobody can.
So, Carter, let's talk volume on some of these moves, right? I look at Amazon, where it was the last time. Volume seems to be declining on average at these new highs. Does that factor into your analysis at all?
Well, you want to approach the high on heavy volume, and then when you back and fill, you want the volume to dry up because there's no real selling pressure. It means you stuck your landing. And then most breakouts are associated with big volume if and as you do start to exceed the highs.
I want to ask you about Netflix, which is the one stock that has already reported, or the FANG stocks. It's been terrible since it reported earnings.
Right. And in a way, that was a testament to relative strength. So think about Netflix price action if you have it in your mind's eye, if you're looking at a chart right now at home. A huge move in January, and then dead flat February, March, April, May, June. Dead flat in a period where almost all equities are going straight up. That was the problem, relative strength. It was foreshadowing that something was wrong. And then, of course, it gapped down on its earnings.
Right.
It's news related. And I would say even here, it's to be avoided.
To be avoided.
Even now.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. Carter, thank you.
Thanks.
Carter Braxton-Worth, Cornerstone Macro. Outside of earnings, we are continuing to follow a developing story in the oil market. Brent jumping again today as tensions rise in the Middle East. New video released by Iran's Revolutionary Guard shows the dramatic moment when soldiers seized a British oil tanker in the Strait of Hormuz on Friday. So with Mideast tensions mounting, why aren't we seeing a bigger reaction in the price of oil? Or would oil be a lot lower without these tensions?
We talked about, I think, this on Friday. Why isn't oil higher? I think, 5 or 10 years ago, it would have been significantly higher. I think the world has changed. I don't necessarily think geopolitical is as much a proxy to make oil go higher as it was a decade or so ago. So I think it actually makes sense. To answer your question, would it be lower? I don't think it would be anywhere. Probably be sort of meandering where it is now. I'm surprised, if you want to go second level, that the broader market didn't sell off today, frankly, on the back of all this. I think people are discounting it. And again, I'll say it again, a VIX at 14 or wherever we are now, prior to this was too cheap. Now with all this happening, I think it's really just too cheap.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at oil prior to this, it was a well-supplied market, right? And particularly if you're talking about an economy, a global economy that's slowing, some of the biggest buyers out there, obviously China, that's slowing down. So you don't have as much demand for it. So I was actually surprised you didn't see oil up. I thought it'd be up 4 or 5% today. I thought that could be very easily it. But to me, it just goes to the what the investors in oil are thinking is that, you know what, we've got plenty of oil. The economy isn't that great. The demand's not going to come in there. And so perhaps this is a one-off. You know, if you talk about war in the Middle East, that doesn't do pretty much anybody any good. Iran certainly doesn't want it. We certainly don't want it. So perhaps they're thinking there's some sort of resolution here as well.
I mean, Guy mentioned volatility. I mean, it's amazing. We have this huge earnings week. We've got Middle East tensions, and the VIX came down 6% today.
I know. At 13.5, it went out. That is amazing to me. So I'm long puts. I'm happy to own them at this price. I agree. You would think in days past, years past, oil would have moved substantially. But I think that, as Brian said, neither side wants war. They both know that it's just talk. I believe that it's just talk. And so we're seeing this muted response. I'm very surprised the market's up today. S&P's up 12.
Yeah, as far as oil goes, supply disruption does not work in a period when you've got global growth concerns. And we've seen this over and over again. And the times when actually you saw a gap higher on this kind of news, really, or a sustainable gap higher, was when actually there was underlying demand. You actually were in the commodity super cycle. So interesting, though, on a relative basis. Again, the underperformance of the energy sector and the energy stocks is even more extreme when you look at the oil services sector. So you had Halliburton report today. Mm-hmm. And while the numbers were not good. They were better than expected. In fact, Halliburton gaps up over 7% today on the fact that they effectively, their profitability in a very poor environment means these guys are running much more efficiently. And that seems to be the story. Stocks down 51% year over year. So relative to the market, again, the underperformance is staggering.
All right. We'll hear much more about the rising tensions in the Middle East and the impact on the oil market. Be sure to catch our interview with retired four-star Army General David Petraeus. That's tomorrow noon Eastern time on CNBC. Coming up, we got your call of the day. Goldman Sachs getting bullish on the chip stocks, but is it too little too late? We'll debate that. And later, the one stock that could be a big canary in the coal mine for Ford. We'll bring you that name ahead. We're live from Times Square in New York City. Much more Fast Money right after this. Welcome back to Fast Money. Check out shares of Micron surging today after Goldman Sachs upgraded the chip maker to a buy. It is our call of the day. Goldman getting bullish on the chip, saying in part Micron will trade on positive memory pricing trends. The stock is up already more than 40% over the past month. So do you chase here, Tim?
Well, and let's note the difference in the chip stocks. It's one thing to be bullish on memory. It's another thing to be going after some of the higher tech chips and look at gaming and look at the cyclicality of the sector overall, which, you know, if you want to be cynical, you can say, hey, you know, that's great for Goldman upgrading semis after they've moved 21% in the last 34 days, except for the fact that the one part that they've upgraded is the part that's really underperformed. So the argument here for Micron is that a reduction in supply coming out of the Toshiba outage is something that should be bought, and that you've actually worked through some of the oversupply just for this alone. Valuation is not a reason to buy these stocks. And as I talk to I think the broader base of that sector, I do actually think that semis are starting to price in almost perfection in not only a trade deal, but a recovery in cyclicality. And I think it looks a little bit ominous here. And you can make an argument we're right back up at that top where we failed a couple times.
There's a lot of calls. I mean, part of this call was Goldman also downgrading Marvell, Intel getting a downgrade, and AMD getting an upgrade over Atlantic Equities. And where would you go?
Yeah, here? So it was a little more nuanced than just a general semis upgrade, right? And what I thought was kind of interesting is when you look at some of Goldman's other research where they're talking about maybe the market has topped out the market in general, if you really thought that you're going to have this semi surge higher, you would say, you know, the whole market's going to go higher. So maybe there's better places to go. I look at Micron close to $50. That's where it broke down before. I don't think you're discovering anything new. You're not Lewis and Clark here. So for me, you get a chance to buy a little bit lower.
Nice. Fantastic.
Well, I agree with what Tim said about, you know, it's pricing in a lot of optimism on the China deal and a lot of optimism on the U.S. economy, global, but mainly U.S. economy. So I'm nervous about both of those things. So to me, you know, they're all going to move together, and I don't have a lot of exposure to the space.
You know, we talked about this. Micron was definitely too cheap at 32.5. We had those conversations. You know, reported earnings. The earnings were not great, but we talked about how it made sense. Now, with that said, I thought it would absolutely fail at 39.5. As a matter of fact, a couple of options actions ago, if you may recall, Coco Beware and I did a little bit of a
tag team.
Yeah, and I picked the stock. Don't get mad at Mike. It was me, but we had a bearish bet on Micron. Clearly, that's not working out. With that said, though, we've been pretty steadfast on other names. Xilinx reports, I believe, on Wednesday. That sets up pretty well under earnings. But the one that you should take a look at and maybe start taking some money off the table is Lam Research. Look where it traded up to in May. Look where it traded down to. Look where it is now. Look, the stock's had a tremendous run, but to take profits in Lam Research right now makes some sense to me.
You'll notice a headline at the bottom of your screen, Apple's in advanced talks to buy Intel's smartphone modem business. We are seeing shares of Intel trade higher in the after-hours session now to the tune of 2.25%. Tim, you're mentioning various parts of the supply chain.
Right.
Intel gets rid of this business. Good for Intel?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is a failed start for them. Again, remember, Intel was trying very hard to get themselves into the handset business or be a major part of the handset business. And I'm not sure what this does for Apple. I will say, if you listen to distributor Arrow, who, you know, just last week basically gave poor guidance for the first time in 15 quarters, it tells you they're actually seeing in components really a lot of weakness. And they're actually seeing a buildup in inventory. So I do think it's a case where there's below the surface, there's a lot of different stories to be told. But this headline is very interesting, I think, from the Apple side.
And yeah. Qualcomm trading down.
Qualcomm is trading lower.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. 5%. I mean, the theory, I guess, being that Apple will move away from buying chipsets elsewhere and go
right.
to its
but,
own business.
But the signaling for Apple, this is a company that is supposed to be going into the services, it's supposed to be growing that. We've all been waiting to find out what they're going to do in that area. Now all of a sudden to come out and start buying a chipmaker, because I get strategically why they're doing it. They want to lock in that supply chain. I understand that. But I actually think Apple would be up a heck of a lot more if they bought somebody else out. Let's say they bought Square or something like that. That type of business, I think, would make a big difference.
It doesn't preclude the other. And if they can get their costs down on the hardware side, that
would be gigantic for them. They can afford it, but that's a very big deal.
But they need, the problem with Apple is they don't really have an app. That's great, right? We're all talking about these services, but on my phone, I can look at a bunch of different apps and none of them are Apple apps because they're not the best out there.
But you're buying them on Apple. You're buying them on the App Store. I mean, to the extent that I think that's the biggest concern I think Apple investors should have right now is that the App Store doesn't need to be the place to go, and that's been a major part of the services growth. So I would be worried there.
So Intel, last I looked, is about a $240 billion market cap company. There are many reasons to be bullish Intel or bearish, but I'm hard-pressed to understand why this deal, which on the headline at least is valued a little over $1 billion, is moving the stock an additional 2.5% to the upside and was up 2% today. I mean, again, you can be bullish Intel, that's fine, but I don't know why this moves the needle, at least in the aftermarket, as much as it is right now.
All right. Again, this deal is according to Dow Jones, so we'll closely monitor this and bring you any more developments as we have them. In the meantime, you get more on chips on our website on CNBC.com. I'm Melissa Lee. You're watching Fast Money on CNBC. Here's what else is coming up on the show.
Time to take cover or time to get in? Why, one top strategist says a pullback is coming, but that could be the perfect buying opportunity. He'll make his case. And later, a star is born. I'm of the deep end. No, we're not talking Hollywood. We're talking China. We'll explain when Fast Money returns.
Welcome back to Fast Money. I'm Melissa Lee. Hold on tight. A top market strategist says a stomach-churning pullback is underway, but says resist the urge to sell. Let's bring in Tony Dwyer, the chief market strategist at Canaccord Genuity. Tony, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Mel.
What kind of pullback are we talking about?
Almost exactly like the May pullback. You know, it's not that, first of all, think of the term from Marty Zweig, don't fight the Fed. Why isn't it follow the Fed? Because human nature is always there's something wrong when the Fed is cutting rates, so you should fight them. So that, you know, it's don't fight the Fed, but that was so it's not Fed related. It's not fundamentally related. It really comes down to we've had a heck of a move off of the May low and things got overbought a little bit too enthusiastic, exactly where we were on April 30th when we came on the show and made the call. And this was from last week.
So you're saying like a 5% or so pullback. And at that point, you should buy that dip.
But
if you're fully invested here, don't do anything.
And I've said it so many times on the show that it's almost boring. Until credit shuts down, you want to buy every dip. That's the fact of being at a new high. So I think it's a really important point. As long as credit is open, which it is, you want to buy the dip.
As long as there's a race to the bottom in rates, Tony, I mean, don't fight the Fed. Does that still hold water? I mean, we're looking at an ECB meeting this week. There's talk about them doing a preemptive cut in order to offset what the fallout could be on the euro. So if all this is happening, does don't fight the Fed still hold water?
There's been a shift. A major shift. I've even almost called it a generational shift in Fed thinking. You've got unemployment at the lowest level in history, or one of the lowest levels in history. They raised rates because they're worried about the impact on overall inflation because of labor inflation, right? And you got 1.6% core PCE, which for the viewers, that's core inflation. You got to be pretty scared. If you got unemployment at the lowest level it's been at, solid gains in average hourly earnings, and the best you got is 1.6%. So what they've been saying in the last month is very important that Steve Leisman picked up on, and not everybody picked up on, in my opinion. It's not focused on enough. They said they don't want to be Japan and now Europe. They're telling you that Japan and Europe are in this negative rate environment that they can't get out of. He told you he doesn't want to be there. That tells me, they're going to be a lot more aggressive. And remember, we've been looking for a Fed rate cut in the summertime since December. This is going to get aggressive, in our opinion. Not because the economy is tanking, but if all of a sudden inflation expectations go too low and you start to spiral down in interest rates, you got a problem. So they're going to try and beat that before it happens. And they may already be too late.
So, Tony, if the only thing that we have to worry about is credit shutting down, tell the folks at home, what do we look for? What does that look like? What does credit shutting down look like?
It's a great question. It's corporate credit spreads. So you take a look at high yield debt, the Barclays high yield debt relative to treasuries. There's something that anybody can get. Go to the Chicago Fed website. On there, you can find the National Financial Condition sub-indices. There are three sub-indices that measure 105 indicators of credit stress in banking, shadow banking, and the financial markets. I wake up every day trying to figure out how I'm wrong. So it's not like I come on here and try and figure out, you know, how to be bullish. I look to see if the story's got holes in it. And the only times I've seen sustainable holes in buying a dip is when the credit stress indicators are going bonkers. And in the meantime, two of the three indices are at a cycle lower right next to it. So until you get that credit, look at 2018, look at 2015, 16, look at 2011. The way that I kind of categorize the economy is it's almost like bumper bowling. You know bumper bowling with your kids?
No.
You can't.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, you do.
You can't get in the gutter,
I've right?
I've bowled my life.
Right. So bumper bowling
like
is you can't throw the ball down the lane and get in the gutter.
Yeah.
So what economically is there's too much debt. You cannot fix debt with exponentially more debt. This is not going to end well. But when you get up to 3%, you're hitting the left bumper and you come back in, slows right. The economy down. You get back to 2%, wow, we get to refi that debt we did above 2.5%, picks the economy up. Why are the, could you have a reacceleration next year? Because rates went from 3.25 to 2%.
Right.
There's a massive refi boom going on that's going to end up with reacceleration. The whole story in the first half was it's going to slow down and that's the bull story. Now it's the opposite.
Tony, good to see you. Thank you. Tony
Thank
Dwyer,
you for letting me rant now.
Putting
metaphor.
Aside a discussion of bumper bowling, because I know that is going to spark some controversy here on this desk.
I was
going to
actually talk about it.
I think we should go bumper bowl. Look, Tony's talking about potential asset bubbles and leveraged loans in U.S. Treasuries and U.S. corporate bonds. You can't disagree with that. Correlation between stocks and bonds right now is almost one. That concerns me.
Still ahead, a big tech meeting on Huawei wrapping up at the White House. We'll take you live to Washington with all the details. Plus, shares of Whirlpool on the move in the after hours after reporting results. We'll break down the key headlines when Fast Money returns. Welcome back to Fast Money. I'm Melissa Lee. Big tech leaders wrapping up a meeting at the White House on Huawei. Let's get to Elon Moy live in Washington with the latest. Elon.
Melissa, that meeting lasted for just over an hour or so. You can see the CEO of Broadcom leaving there. We also saw the top executives from Micron, Qualcomm, and Cisco earlier in the day. And I'm told that President Trump did attend at least a portion of the meeting. So we know that he's now heard directly from U.S. chip makers and other technology companies about the impact that these restrictions on doing business with Huawei is having on their own bottom lines. Now, the administration here is trying to strike a balance. On the one hand, it's trying to acknowledge that global supply chains are very difficult to unravel, but also it doesn't want to be seen as walking back from its hard stance on Huawei. Earlier today, President Trump spoke to reporters in the Oval Office, and he says the U.S. wants to be a leader in 5G.
I know all about Huawei, I know all about 5G, and we're working on it, and we have companies that are now getting very, very strong in that department. And we're going to have 5G, we're going to have the best 5G in the world, just like we have everything else. Our Silicon Valley cannot be competed with. There's nobody that can compete with Silicon Valley for the brain power or for what we do.
Now, Trump said he also wants to find out more about a report that Huawei helped North Korea build its wireless infrastructure. So, Melissa, this is one reason that China hawks on Capitol Hill say that Huawei remains a national security threat. Back to you.
All right, Elon. Thank you, Elon Moy. There's a lot of ways to go on this Huawei story in terms of trading it. There's the impact on the chip makers, but then there's also the potential impact on any sort of China trade deal here.
I think the trade deal is the most interesting thing, right? I think the president is trying to walk this fine line. There are bipartisan hawks adamantly against Huawei doing any business with them in any way, shape, or form. Then I think the president says, listen, we can strip out the stuff that's sort of risk to our national security and then still do business. I don't know if you can walk that tightrope, but I think that's what he's trying to do to get this deal done. With that said, I don't think we're close to getting a deal done. And I'll say it again. I've said it for quite some time.
You know, that Washington Post article, I don't know if you guys got a chance to read it, but it's fascinating stuff. Done very well. Basically, they found that over the span of 8 years or so, Huawei, along with a state-owned enterprise, Panda International, helped develop the wireless infrastructure for North Korea. So effectively, I mean, it sounds like Huawei and this other company, this Chinese company, helped North Korea violate or get around sanctions in terms of building out its own structure.
Look, I think China has been very opportunistic with North Korea, and there's been enough cooperation that you know, all of the reasons to want to control not only Huawei but 68 other companies that were banned. I mean, this is not just Huawei. So it's about reaching into that network and that web. And I think it's not just the U.S. government too. It's also interesting that the rest of the European governments, UK met today and essentially talked about they are waiting until the U.S. is clear. They're not going to do anything on this, too. So the rest of the world waits while we kind of figure this one out. I hate to make it sound so U.S.-centric, but I don't think the U.S. stands alone on this issue. And I do think it's, as Guy said, not something that's easily resolved. In fact, this is right up there with One Belt, One Road, Made in China 2020. Roll out of 5G. Are you kidding me? Who do you think wants to be first? Everybody.
Right. Here's another big story that we're following overseas. German auto parts supplier Continental Tire slashing its outlook for the rest of this year. The company citing a slowdown in global auto production and changing consumer demand. And BK, you flagged this. You thought this could be a canary in the coal mine when it comes to
yeah.
a big automaker's report.
That's right.
Week.
So we have Ford reporting later this week. We saw last week that European car sales were terrible. Now Continental comes out and says, listen, things are not that great out there. And what I found kind of interesting about this is that, you know, Volkswagen's one of their largest customers. You already have the ECB at negative rates, right? So Tony Dwyer is here talking a little bit about, you know, the fact that the Fed doesn't want to be trapped in this. You start to see stuff like this, and I do think you get the Fed to be a lot more aggressive. We have Ford coming out later this week. We'll see how auto sales here in the U.S., but that is a big part of consumer demand here. So again, talk about a stagnating and slowing economy makes me awful cautious out there.
Karen.
Yeah, I don't love to hear it. I am long GM, although I'd rather be in GM over Ford. GM has really pared down their exposure to Europe to really as a shareholder, and Ford still has exposure to Europe. So that's where I'd rather be. But, I mean, they all just trade, well, GM, I should just speak for the one I own, doesn't trade well at all,
right,
given the earnings power that it has. I'd like to see them put up another good quarter. Hopefully one day they get credit for it, but it doesn't seem to be the case in the short term.
Think about the warnings and the bad news that we've gotten out of a lot of German companies, SAP, Bosch. We also, not Bosch, BASF, yeah, and then Continental now, ahead of an ECB meeting on Thursday.
Yeah, and one of the things that global markets and investors should be happy about is that the German economy needs the ECB to be as dovish as possible. In fact, it was the Germans that, you know, at times have been the ones pushing back. And the days before Draghi really asserted himself, the Bundesbank effectively was behind the scenes. But Brian brings up a great point. There's no question, you know, auto sales have been under pressure. And I think that's it. When I look at U.S. SARs, I don't think we're expecting any miracles here. In fact, peak auto, I think, was a trade 3 years ago. I look at GM, it's up 20% off those lows with a six and a half times earnings multiple. I agree with Karen. I mean, I don't know what it takes to knock it out of this range, but I feel very comfortable holding this company in this environment.
All right. Still ahead, Boeing hitting some more turbulence in today's session. Coming up, how you can trade around the negative headlines. Plus, shares of Whirlpool on the move in the after-hour session. We'll tell you what Wall Street had to say about its report. Much more Fast Money right after this. Welcome back to Fast Money. Two ratings agencies slashing their outlook on Boeing. Let's get to Phil LeBeau for the details. Hey, Phil.
And Melissa, we should point out that this is an outlook change, not the actual credit rating. And it's coming from both Fitch and Moody's, both of them taking their credit outlooks for Boeing from stable, moving it down to negative. And they all basically say the same thing. When you look at both of these notes, they cite a host of potential issues regarding the 737 MAX, whether it's can they deliver these or get these planes back in the air by the fourth quarter, as is the assumption. Will things have to be pushed out into next year? Increasing costs, increasing financial exposure. And again, we should point out they are not lowering the credit rating of Boeing. Remember, Boeing reports earnings on Wednesday. Now, it was just last week that the company said you can expect the earnings to be reduced by at least $5 billion when they report their Q2 earnings. And again, that happens before the bell. The conference call with Dennis Muilenburg and what analysts get to ask him, that's really the focus on Wednesday. Also, in regards to airlines that have exposure to the MAX, don't forget that American, it has 24 737 MAXs. It will be reporting earnings on Thursday morning. We'll be talking with Doug Parker, CEO of American, not only about the MAX, but really where this airline is as they head into the second, or they fly now in the second half of this year. Melissa?
All right, Phil, thanks. Phil LeBeau in Chicago for us. Let's trade Boeing. First of all, I mean, one of the points that at least Fitch was making, Guy, was that operating margins would be impacted for years to come.
I'm not surprised. I don't think it's going to be for years to come. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Fitch should know better than I would think, but I'm hard-pressed to believe it's going to be for years to come. I think Boeing will rebound from this, and I understand the stock was down today. It makes sense, especially given the bounce. But I'll say this. The rating agencies historically have been late to the dance, and I think they're late to the dance on this one. I would still favor being long Boeing here than short it or not position it at all.
But the risk to Boeing here is that this delay goes on for longer and longer, and people just go and order elsewhere. We've already seen several airlines go and switch some orders, and that is the risk here. Not only that, we don't know what other kind of investigations are out there. There's been a lot of stuff out there. So just buying the stock, I think you're subject to all these headline risks that I'd rather not be subject to.
Which brings us to the question of how do you trade stocks with headline risks? We saw a couple of instances even just in today's news, Johnson & Johnson heading to court over talc cases, alleging that talc and talc products cause ovarian cancer. We have the Equifax settlement, $700 million with the FTC over the huge privacy breach. Karen, how do you separate what is worth taking pause and what is worth sort of putting stock into?
So it's really hard to know ultimately, but I look at something like Boeing and obviously, we've had tons and tons of bad news. And at some point, the market just gets inured to bad news. It stops going down on news that a month or two ago would have really been negative. So this credit news today, I really look at is really not important to the Boeing story because this isn't a credit story. Maybe their margins would be impacted, but still, that wouldn't. I don't think the credit story is important here. I just think it's sentiment just gets sort of washed out. And we saw it in Facebook when they had bad news and then more bad news. And then more recently, they had what would have been bad news,
the FTC settlement.
That actually was a positive, but they had a very large number of accounts that they had been exposed to. I don't know who, but that I don't even remember the news exactly. That there's my point, that at some point the market sort of gets. They're tired of hearing bad news and reacting to it. And we've seen it. We saw Facebook bottom. We saw, I think Boeing bottomed a month or so ago.
Well, how about a case like a Johnson & Johnson where talc is a tiny percentage of revenues. And yet we did see the stock move lower to December. And we're back to those December lows.
But I think it's a company that people were struggling with their not only just their consumer products business, but also their medical products business, and then their pharma pipeline. I've made the argument recently on the show that I like J&J relative to their big pharma business relative to the peers, because they're growing high single digits. That's something the other guys are not doing. I think both of these companies, back to your original question, in an environment where you're worried about global growth, these are both very defensive companies with fantastic balance sheets, and I think you gravitate towards them until the news flow changes from here.
All right, breaking news out of Washington on the debt ceiling. Contessa Brewer's got all the details. Contessa.
Melissa, it looks like we may have a deal here on the debt ceiling. The president has just tweeted, quote, "I'm pleased to announce that a deal has been struck with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, and House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy on a two-year budget and debt ceiling with no poison pills." The president then replying to his own tweet says this was a real compromise in order to give another big victory to our great military and vets. Remember, there had been this standoff over how to consider funding for the VA mission, whether that was going to consider it on parity with the military and non-military spending. According to the president, a deal's been done, and this one a two-year deal. That was a big relief because the House goes into August recess on Friday. Melissa?
Yep, just made it by the deadline. Yep. Contessa, thank you. Contessa Brewer. I would think this is good news for the market. On the other hand, this removes one more reason why the Fed might act and might act aggressively next week.
Well, you can't say the market's been, well, who knows, but it's hard to make an argument that the market's been concerned about this as we sit around all-time highs. So it's not bad news for the market, but I can't believe we're going to get a meaningful rally on the back of this headline.
This goes back to one of Tony's statements and something we talk about, though. You know, in terms of asset bubbles, U.S. government debt, the federal debt level is at essentially post-World War II highs in a 10-year recovery. How do you explain that? Talk about asset bubbles that are created by too much money out there and a lack of fiscal responsibility. And at some point, the U.S. government's going to have to pay for it. Right now, it looks like yields are going lower.
Yeah, not right now. What percentage of the world's sovereign paper at
that's
zero
exactly
or lower?
Right.
That's fine. The asset, essentially the credit bubbles that are European debt and then leveraged loans, you know, maybe make the U.S. look like a better relative value. Right. But there's no way we should have this debt level 10 years into a recovery.
Yeah, but the point is that's the reason why the market hasn't reacted to this, what negatively or positively, is because everybody knows you have to come and buy U.S. debt at this point in time if you're an investor, because you get 2% versus -%. So, I mean, do the math, care of the nine, that's better.
Much more Fast Money after this
Lewis
quick
and
break.
Clark.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Snap reporting earnings after the bell tomorrow. The stock has had an incredible run this year, up more than 150%. And one options trader is betting that the rally will continue. Mike Coe's in San Francisco with the options action. Hey, Mike.
Yeah, actually, there might be several options traders that are betting that the rally could continue, because we saw calls outpace puts by about 4-1 today on above average volume. This is a stock that typically moves quite sharply on earnings. It's averaged nearly 17% over the last 8 quarters, and this week it's implying a move of about 14% by the end of the week. An example of one of the bullish bets that we saw was the August 15 calls. Somebody spent 84 cents to buy 1,365 of those. As inexpensive as those calls seem, that basically represents a move of about 12% by August expiration to the upside, at least just for these calls to break even. That would be in just over 3 weeks.
All right. Thanks, Mike, for that. Guy, what do you think of Snap?
I tell you, our friend Dan Nathan, who appears on this show regularly, has been bullish Snap, and I'm with Mike on this one. Options are saying it's going higher. You can make a lot of compelling arguments why the stock should be lower, but it's not. I think it continues to go higher from here. As much as it makes no sense to me, the stock goes higher from here.
All right. For more options action, check out the full show Fridays, 5:30 p.m. Eastern time. Up next, final trades. Take a look at Whirlpool bouncing around in the after-hour session. The stock was up big after reporting an earnings beat. It also raised its forecast, but it's since come down. The call is tomorrow, so what we have is a press release, and they did say that price increases were, offset a lot of the impacts from higher input costs, raw materials.
Right. So that's why the stock was up in the beginning, right? So they came out and said, listen, we've got tariffs, we've got all these raw material costs, but we're able to raise prices. That's a double-edged sword, though, because they also said that sales volume could go lower. So that's what the market's trying to figure out right now, is that are these increased prices going to reduce the amount of sales that they have?
Again, conference call tomorrow. Final trade time, Tim.
Yeah, we talked about autos today. Again, let me reiterate that I think GM, which doesn't report till August, is a fantastic buy at 6.2 times earnings, and they've reiterated every time and hit and beat.
Karen.
Yes, in the retail space, I do like Target, even though it's had a really nice run. I think it's still got some room to go, not expensive relative to the Walmarts of the world.
BK Brian Kelly.
You know, when a market doesn't do what you think it should do, then you need to go to the other side of it. So look at oil today. We're supposed to be up 4 or 5%. You sell XOP.
That was like a riddle.
Yeah.
I heard Karen crush OA number one.
Yes.
Number two, Delta Airlines all-time high. I think it continues to go higher.
Mad Money's up next. Stay tuned.